Hey everyone, welcome back to Boat by the Podcast, the podcast where every week myself, Adrian, and Matt talk about the things in pop culture that people say matter and ask the question, but why though? Before we get started, I wanted to make sure to let you all know that the easiest way to support us is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you're listening. It helps other people find us and helps get our ratings up. But if you want to support us a little more, you can head on over to our Patreon at patreon.com/butwhythoughpc. And as always, enjoy the show. Welcome back to But Why the Podcast, and today we are finding out who was coming to get Barbara. As always, I'm your host, Kate, and I'm here with Adrian.
Hey, how's it going?
And Matt.
Hello.
And a special guest, Carolyn, from So Here's What Happens podcast, the host, one of the hosts of the Saturday Night Sci-Fi live tweets, which are amazing and you need to check out, and she's a writer, and she just does everything.
Thank you. Hello, hello.
Hey, Carolyn, thanks for coming on to talk about what Kate's going to introduce in a
second. No problem.
I don't want to take her thunder from introducing stuff.
We're talking about Night of the Living Dead and pretty much what it's done. Mm-hmm. So that's the topic. I'm excited. If you've listened to this podcast for a while, you know I love horror. You know the guys are okay with being on an episode about horror.
So I'm here so I don't get fined.
I knew you were going to say that.
I'm here because the only horror I can go with is zombies, because I think zombies are interesting.
Really? Only zombies?
Yeah. There's lots of variety in zombies and lots of comedy with zombies, which isn't like with other horror stuff.
So oh, that's true. It's true.
I just don't know a whole lot, so.
And I'm here because I just like horror.
Me too, basically.
But the real question is, why is Carolyn here?
Why I'm here? I love horror. But honestly, I only started getting back into horror actively within the last few years because I used to watch a lot of it back when I was younger. Probably I started way too young. I used to read like Goosebumps. I read like Anne Rice. What's her name? It's Anne Rice. Yeah, and I read a whole, and I used to read books about like Walcott and stuff, but then I'm like, I had some experiences, and I'm like, you know what, I'm gonna take a break, because I'm from the Caribbean, and we don't deal with like the occult, like we like, with like, grew up in a heavy Christian influenced home and like community, so it's like, we don't deal with like the occult stuff, like witches and spells, that's not my tea, but I started to get back into it a few years ago, because I've always liked sci-fi and supernatural and horror together. So, you know, like Underworld, World War Z, I'm drawing a complete blank. Oh my gosh, the Umbrella Corporation. Umbrella Corporation, that's...
Oh!
Resident Evil franchise and those ones. So, like, I like those kind of horrors. But then I watched Train to Busan, and that just reignited my love of horror again. And I take any opportunity to talk
That's
about
really,
that
That's really, really great to hear. Awesome. And we'll talk about it at the end, because I think Train to Busan brought a lot of people who were burnt out on zombies back in. So our opening question this episode is, what is a zombie? Adrian, do you want to go first?
The thing
There is that... a correct answer, apparently, to this.
Oh, there's a correct answer?
I feel like there is.
Why did I go first? zombies. It's so hard. I don't know, because whatever I'm going to say is going to be wrong.
No, it's not
going
to be wrong. No, because like...
Brain dead things that eat people that can be either slow or fast, depending on the movie. But they eat brains. And you're supposed to shoot them in the face to kill them. That's a zombie.
Not just the face. Okay. It has to be the brain.
Yeah. You can't hit the nose if they die.
Exactly.
Yeah. See? I told you. Why didn't Matt go first?
Actually, you'll see down at the end, there's a relation to what you just said. Mm-hmm. Matt?
I was not prepared for this. I'm going to go with, obviously they eat brains if they are not alive. And they have, that's about it. They're just dead. They're just dead things that walk around and want to feed.
Okay, that's... I define a zombie as anything that is cannibalizing another human being with no control of their faculties. Mm,
that's interesting. Well, for me, I see a zombie as something that died medically but became reanimated and somehow functions... has enough function to walk, breathe, and eat, and see, and sense. So basically, they're alive. So like, as Jared A. Romero so wonderfully titled them, the living dead. So basically, and they always start, we never know exactly what starts them. We don't know what virus, how the virus like affects the brain, that kind of stuff. So we never know exactly how.
Yours was very, very prepared and detailed. So I'm glad we have you on.
Thank you.
Yeah, but that is, like, the perfect transition into what we're talking about, because The Night of the Living Dead is a 1968 American independent horror film written and directed and photographed and edited by George A. Romero. It was also co-written by John Russo, and it stars Dwayne Jones and Judith O'Day in the main roles. And the story follows seven people who are trapped in a rural farmhouse in western Pennsylvania, which is besieged by a large and growing group of living dead monsters. The reason we're covering it is because The Night of the Living Dead is one of the cornerstones of horror cinema in general. It defines what we know of as zombies, and we'll get into that in the But Why Those, and it is constantly being referenced most recently in Jordan Peele's Get Out. So the film itself was completed on a $114,000 budget and was shot outside Pittsburgh, where it had its theatrical premiere on October 1st of 1968. The film...
What was the budget again?
$114,000?
Okay.
Did I miss say that?
No, you're right.
You sound like you said a... Yeah, no, said you're right. But
okay.
It sounded like you said $114,000.
Yeah, I think that is what she said.
Oh, yeah, that's okay. I wasn't crazy. Okay. I was like, what?
Carolyn, what? <get this out.
laughs> I was so thrown off. I was like, I'm going to ask her again.
Okay, $114,000. $114,000 is the correct number of what this movie was made on. And it ended up grossing $12 million domestically and $18 million internationally, which means that it grossed over 250 times its budget. Mm-hmm,
which is amazing.
Which is crazy. Like... Night of the Living Dead has been regarded as a cult classic by film scholars and critics, despite it being heavily criticized when it was released because of its explicit gore. It eventually garnered critical acclaim and has been selected by the Library of Congress for preservation in the National Film Registry as it was deemed culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. So not every old film makes it into the Library of Congress. So to cover the cast... you have Dwayne Jones as Ben, an unknown, he started out as an unknown stage actor, and Jones' performance depicted Ben. Casting a Jones as a hero was potentially controversial in 1968, because it was not typical for a black man to be a hero in an American film, when the rest of the cast was also composed of white actors. But Romero has said this multiple times, that Jones was the best person for the job to embody this character, and so he got the job. He gave the best audition. Judith O'Day was a 23-year-old commercial and stage actress. Carl Hardman was Harry Cooper, one of the film's producers. And Hardman is also the voice of the newscaster heard on the radio in Johnny's car. And Johnny is Barbara's brother. Marilyn Eastman starred as Helen Cooper. Anne Eastman also played a female ghoul who was eating an insect. Keith Wayne was Tom. Judith Reilly was Judy. And I, one of the reasons why I just kind of wanted to run through a little bit of the cast, at least, was to point out that a lot of these people either played ghouls as well, and ghouls is what they were called in Night of the Living Dead. So instead of using zombies, they were referred to as ghouls. And so one of the cool things is that Night of the Living Dead, even though it is the foundation of the modern zombie movie, they never once say the word zombie in the movie at all. And Romero himself, not until later on, referred to them as that.
So what's the difference between a zombie and a ghoul?
Nothing really.
Honestly. Yeah, ghoul is just a term that was, it's like an old English term, actually, that they would have used for that period, that time period. So I think zombie is a more modern term, in 20th century term, but ghoul is like more Victorian era, Edwardian era. So it's basically anything supernatural, anything, any creature that was man-like, but was like vicious and dangerous.
Question, I have one as well. I was just waiting for a point to ask. So on episode 8 of our podcast, Way in the Way Back Machine, we had a conversation about undead versus infected mm-hmm. humans. I just didn't know if Carolyn had any thoughts on that, on if there's like a difference in relation to zombies, or if they're just, like you said, just different things to call. Or was it? Sorry.
Well, never mind.
So I don't want to read the notes, man, because sometimes I...
We'll file that away till later.
Yeah.
You know, I guess we'll follow that.
Good job, Adrian.
But can I answer Matt's question? I just googled the word where the word zombie came from, so I just looked it up on Wikipedia. So it's actually a Haitian Creole, is based off of a Haitian Creole word, zombie, ZONBI. So which is a fictional undead being created through the reanimation of a human corpse. So that's where the word actually comes from. I'm looking to see if it says, well, the English word was first recorded in 1819 in a history of Brazil by the poet Robert Southey in the form of zombies, ZOMBI. So Oxford Dictionary gives the origin of the word as West African, which makes sense if it's Haitian Creole, and compares it to the Congo word Nzambi, which means God, and Zumbi, ZUMBI, which means fetish.
That's really cool.
It's a pretty good name. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. But yeah, no, and that's really cool. And that's one of the reasons. So I knew that it came from the Caribbean because before, and this comes in a little bit later, but that the Caribbean zombie, or I believe the Haitian zombie, is what we see in horror up until this point. And then everybody essentially takes that term and then starts applying it to what George A. Romero created. And then, like Carolyn said, he just called these ghouls. It was co-written as a horror comedy, like I said, by Russo and Romero, under the title Monster Flick initially. And an early screenplay draft concerned the exploits of adolescent aliens who visit Earth and befriend human teenagers.
Wow.
Yeah. A second version of the script featured a young man who runs away from home and discovers rotting human corpses that aliens use for food scattered across a meadow. Russo came up with the concept that they would be the recently dead only because they could not afford to bring long dead people out of their graves. He also came up with the idea that they would have to be flesh eaters. So in the final draft of the script, written mainly by Russo during 3 days in 1967, focused on reanimated human corpses, which is where we get Carolyn's definition. Romero refers to them as ghouls, like I said, that consume the flesh of the living. In a 1987 interview with BBC's Forbidden Weekend, Romero explained that the script developed into a three-part short story. Part one became Night of the Living Dead, and sequels Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead were adapted from the two remaining parts of that. Romero also talked about drawing inspiration from Richard Matheson's I Am Legend from 1954, which was a horror novel about a plague that ravages futuristic Los Angeles. Yes, it is the Will Smith movie.
That poor dog.
Man.
I know.
The dog and the mannequin. Good dog. Broke my heart.
So in I Am Legend, the affected become vampire-like creatures that prey on the uninfected. Discussing the creation of Night of the Living Dead, Romero remarked, I had written a short story, which I basically ripped off of Richard Matheson's novel called I Am Legend. So this is a fact that I didn't know before looking it up, and I don't think a lot of people know that, that essentially the line between vampire and zombie is super, super small, especially when you think about the modern one with Romero. Because they...
Isn't it just like brain activity? Huh? Isn't it just really brain
activity? Well, vampires don't eat flesh.
Yeah, they just want the blood. And they also have the ability to decide to control who they turn and who they don't turn, because every vampire bite does not result in someone turning into a vampire. You can either die because of blood loss, or you survive, and some, and they then they, like, I guess whatever, enzymes, whatever, they select who they want to turn into a vampire. Whereas for a zombie, you get bitten, turn into a zombie, you die. Period.
Yeah, and that seems to be, like, the common theme throughout almost all zombie lore. You bite, you die. Other things change sometimes, but that's, like, standard.
Mm-hmm.
Die and reanimate, or just die sometimes.
Two choices. Die from infection or blood loss, you know.
Exactly. So, that was really, really quick, and that's because I want to get into kind of what this movie starts, because it is the foundation. So, when you look at the plot of the movie, it's really, really simple, and it's kind of, although that this starts its own subgenres of horror, so zombie and splatter, ultimately it does run like a containment horror movie that we get now, so a lot of it is confined into one setting. Everybody is confined into one farmhouse, and then they have to essentially pick where to defend. The really cool thing that ends up happening in it is you end up like delving into these like really, really creepy areas. Like, the best place to defend would be the attic, but they won't go into the attic because Barbara's terrified of a dead body that's up there.
Hmm. Right out the window.
Great, right? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was like, this is already, once again, why I don't like horror movies.
Well, but they call logic. Out how bad the logic is so many times, but Barbara is just, she's going to be Barbara.
She's a hindrance.
Yeah, she is terrible. She is so bad.
She's a typical white woman in horror. Like, really, chick? Just sit down in a corner.
Yeah. We're going to go down to the basement, guys.
No.
If the zombies get in the house, you have nowhere to go. But one of the really, really great things about the movie is it gives us some really, really terrifying shots. And I don't know. I mean, have you guys seen, has everybody here seen Night of the Living Dead?
I have.
Nope.
I've seen Shaun of the Dead. Is that the same thing?
No.
I've seen that one.
No. Is it not the same thing?
Okay. Well, I was genuinely afraid of it when I was little. And my cousin probably showed it to me when I was way too young. But then again, my grandma was scaring me with La Llorona when I was 4. So it probably was no different. But when you watch the film, one, the fact that Romero shot it in black and white makes it that much more terrifying. And it holds that terrifying atmosphere a lot better than if it was in color. Because there is a colorized version. Yeah. And then on top of that, he uses shots that show these zombies are so human-like. They're not like the zombies that you get in his later movies like Day of the Dead or Land of the Dead or even the current zombies that we have now, which most of the time, like, they look they have veins and they look completely different than human. Like, they're more distant from humanity than they are close to it. And in the original Night of the Living Dead, they were us, which is a really big piece and a really important statement that Romero chose to make, and why he chose to do this, why he chose pretty much the majority of his career to use zombies or infections to tell his stories. And so with Night of the Living Dead, you actually have the emergence of what is called social horror. And what this means is essentially zombies are not about zombies. There's a Smithsonian article that I have cited. So if you're a patron of our Patreon, my sources are included in these notes that I'll put up on the Patreon. There is a Smithsonian article that breaks down how zombies have never been about zombies, and ultimately how they're used to tell stories about us, which is what the majority of horror does. Horror has almost always been used as a vehicle to showcase societal fears, especially in genres like literature or pulp magazines and stuff like that. But ultimately in the 50s and 60s, you get this large focus on like more rompy, but you get a large swath of focusing on different types of Draculas and focusing on different types of Frankensteins. And it's not necessarily in-depth, and it's not always making commentary. Well, what George A. Romero did was essentially he infused and dramatized social issues within his movies. It's also one of the reasons why when people call him a filmmaker, they also call him a satirist. Because in his other movies, like Dawn of the Dead, is very much a satirical commentary on culture. But specifically in Night of the Living Dead, it's, and I'm going to use Jordan Peele as a reference here, because he's, if you're listening to this and you love horror, you're excited for us, but you also watch Get Out. And Jordan Peele has provided a lot of commentary on Night of the Living Dead ever since Get Out came out, because he sees it as one of the foundations of his movies and a lot of horror movies that have come after. He's mentioned how this is the foundation of social horror and horror more general. So one of the things to remember is Ben wasn't written as black initially. The actor played him because he was the best actor. But ultimately what happens is, even though Romero has said to NPR, we never thought of it being a racial piece at all. Never. We were talking much more about how people remain stuck in their own agendas, even though there's something extraordinary going on outside. By casting Ben as a black man, they were able to essentially, there's another layer put on top of that commentary, especially for the time in the 60s. And it's really important. And it's something that if you notice, if you ever watch the movie, if you haven't watched the movie yet and you're listening to this right now, I really recommend you go watch it. Ben is always in control of situations, but you can tell all of the people around him, all of the other people in the farmhouse, don't like that he's in control of situations. And there's a lot of there's subtle racism going on a lot of the time, or it feels like it. And it creates a lot of tension inside of the farmhouse, to where you're not, in kind of akin to how zombie movies and zombie shows are now, there's tension within the humans as well as the tension against the humans and the zombies.
Well, yeah, because let's be real, the main tension between the humans is because Ben is black. Yep. And he's basically he's taking control of a situation where he is the dominant personality and he's the one who's like getting shit done. And, you know, the white people just don't like that. They didn't like it because, again, this was done in 1968, when at the height of the civil rights era, and also Jim Crow was still in effect, and you had police brutality, and the police were like regularly tormenting and persecuting black people in the streets. And so it was reflected, it's in real life, but it was also reflected on screen, right? And we were discussing this recently on the podcast with Horror Noir, and it's also mentioned in the Horror Noir documentary as well, where even though Romero casted Dwayne Jones because he was literally the best for the role, he, as a white man, didn't see the social impact that casting a black man in this role would have. And which kind of shows, when they're serving it, especially with discussions about race, where, I'm going to be completely honest, some way people they look through everything with either rose-tinted glasses or they wear blinders. They're like, I'm only going to see the perspective that I want to see. And he didn't see, to him, he was like, oh, he was seeing it through the camera lens of filming and the script that he wrote, but he didn't see it as a viewer, which I think is kind of ironic. And he didn't have the perspective of sitting back and like looking at the broader picture. So yeah, so that's all reflected in what happens in the film, because these people could not deal with a black man telling them where to go. And if you look at, I'm trying to remember from memory, because I saw the film like years ago, and I looked at some clips, but a lot of the angles are shot where Dwayne Jones, Ben, is usually placed on a visual scale where he's higher or bigger than the other characters. So, like, there are shots where the camera's, like, down low, but based on perspective, he looks, like, bigger and taller, which is, like, a visual representation of his dominant personality over the white characters and the situation.
Yeah. The majority of the film is shot to show that Ben is the one. Like, Ben is the hero. There is never a question that Ben is the hero and Ben is going to either be the one that gets them out or Ben is going to be the last person alive.
The end happens
which is very important, and we're working our way to
so out of all these characters, we talk about the interaction stuff, so like, who allowed Barbara to say let's go to
everybody?
Yes,
but that's a trope that has been carried into horror films, action films, basically any genre of film from then up until now, because again, the bad white ladies
have to happen.
Bad decisions have to happen, but a lot of bad decisions happen because the white lady must be protected at all costs, and her say is the one that matters over everyone's safety. They're like, we all know this is a terrible idea, but you know, she's the fragile flower, so we must protect her and we must do what she wants. I would have been like, you know what, Barbara, you on your own. You want to go to the cellar, go right ahead. You're not going to put me in this mousetrap.
So, everybody here, who would have left Barbara?
Adrian? I'd leave all of you.
He would leave all of us.
I believe it.
Self-preservation is key.
Am I married to Barbara?
No, you're not married to Barbara.
Do I have any emotional... I've never seen the movies. Do I have any emotional connections to Barbara?
No, you are just people surviving in a house because you are...
Oh, no. She's out of here.
Okay.
What if you are married to Barbara?
Oh, yeah. What if you were married to Barbara?
Then I gotta stay with Barbara, man. It's...
Kate, I'm leaving you. We are going to the roof.
Oh, no, that's fine. We're like either both going to make it up to the roof, or one of us is, but we're going to die trying to get up there, because I'm not going to the basement.
Yeah, no, yeah, like, if I'm married to Barbara, I'm literally throwing Barbara over my shoulder and carrying Barbara up to wherever.
Exactly. I'd be like, you can argue. I'd be like, when we survive and alive the next day, then you can argue with me. Until then, Barbara, keep hush. Hush, just hush.
Because that's a smart decision.
Yeah, if my SO is still weaker than me, I'm carrying her through the upstairs. We're not going downstairs.
And it was really a stupid reason too. It was just that she was terrified of this dead body that was up there.
They could have simply thrown the body out the window.
Which is, I'm just like,
literally the only movie I've ever known that like worked of going to the basement was like Signs.
Oh, I thought you were gonna.
A Quiet Place. Because that's the first thing that came to my mind.
That's what I was thinking too.
I was thinking A Quiet Place too, but that was a little bit different because those monsters are scary. Like anywhere you would have gone, you would have been screwed. The gun was just down there.
And it kind of worked because it was soundproof, right? So they had the room soundproofed initially. So yeah.
That movie's super scary. Is that a zombie?
No.
No, I'm just kidding.
But yeah, so like back on the topic. So like you said, Carolyn, like he had no idea what he was doing. Now, he has been quoted as saying that, like, because it was, like, a time of rebellion, and this is obviously from a different lens, he was going to make a statement. And so he said that it was always the talk of the cast and the crew about making a statement, which, as he said, was essentially it's people refusing to give up their agenda. But when you look at it through the lens of, oh, these actors are interacting on screen, and oh, if you look at the lens as a black viewer or as a person of color, it's kind of like, oh, this is actually a really, really strong societal message on race.
Mm-hmm.
And it is one of the reasons why Night of the Living Dead has persisted for so long, because at this time, and I just finished Horror Noir as well, which is an amazing documentary about black horror cinema, and it is phenomenal. And y'all should watch it. It's on Shudder. At this time, I know, but you don't like horror. If you like horror, go watch it.
But you don't even need to like horror to watch a documentary, right? Because I think a lot of the things that are discussed in the film applies to like film in general.
That's fair.
Well, that's fair. Also, I don't like film documentaries.
This one is really good. It's like really fun.
Like,
and it's really funny too.
Okay, we'll see.
But like they said, Ben was one of the first, like, black male protagonists in a horror movie that was a hero. And it had a large societal impact. And that was something that, although Romero didn't mean to do, he did become not only accepting of it, but also pushed that forward towards the end of his career. And as he got, essentially, he realized, like, oh, this is what my film means to people. Instead of being one of those directors that's like, that's not what it means. He's like, okay, this is what it means to people. This is obviously what it means. So, like, I'm not going to say that that's not what happens. He trusted his audience viewing him, and he caused a ripple effect that has happened throughout horror since. And essentially, I took a quote, and it says, and it's from The Atlantic, "The way Night of the Living Dead handles race is so essential to what makes it great. All social norms break down when the event happens and a black man is caged up in a house with a white woman who is terrified. But you're not sure how much she's terrified at the monsters or the outside or the man on the inside who is now the hero." And that's from Jordan Peele. It was from one of the articles published in The Atlantic that I got it from. And it's he's essentially talking about the dynamic that ends up happening throughout the movie and how it pulls out. And this is... Adrian, you saw Get Out, right?
Yes, I've seen Get Out.
Yeah. So at the end scene where he is over the crazy-ass lady and the police car pulls up and the camera zooms in on his face.
Whoa.
And it's at this angle. What? Spoilers?
Hey, it's a TSA.
I know it's a TSA, but you think it's the police. You think it's the police, and there's a reason for that. Okay. There's a close-up of him that's slightly tilted, and when you put that close-up directly up against the close-up of one of the last shots of Ben in The Night of the Living Dead, it's very similar. However, instead of it being the TSA and his friend saving him, Ben is actually shot and murdered in the house that he has just defended and is the last survivor of. And he's murdered by, like, just, like, these, like, random militia-looking dudes. And it's pretty much effective to, and this is one of, like, the large, and you can speak more to this, Carolyn, but this is also one of the lasting social images that it has as a movie, because it's very effective to, you know, the black men being lynched in history and in society at this time, because they end up, they audibly say, that's another one for the fire. And then they pull him out on meat hooks, and it is terrifying to watch. And it just alludes to it a lot, the meat hook piece, but you see them carrying them and you know that's what they're going to do. And then it ends with a giant bonfire, and it crushes you because this was your hero. And in other ways, it crushes you because this is the very real violence that people are going through at the time.
Okay, just kidding. I don't like zombies no more.
Well, the thing is that it wasn't the zombies that killed him, right? Because... The thing that I remember watching this because I was at my dad's house and it was a Sunday, and I watched it because we used to watch a lot of Turner Classic Movies, and Night of the Living Dead was one of the films that was showing on that Sunday. And I remember we were watching it and it came to the end, and when I think it was about 10 maybe, and I said, there's no way he's gonna die. I'm like, it can't. And as soon as I said that, bang, they shot him. I was like, I was like, as a young child, like, I focused mainly on the fact that he was dead, the hero died. But it's only when I got older I realized, wait, so the black man who survived the terror that was killing everyone, who did his best to save all of these white people, who put his life at risk to save all these white people, turns around and gets killed by a bunch of white people without any hesitation. Now, at that time, in 1968, the parallels between what was happening on film and what was happening in real life are, like, super close together. But then, if you watch that film now, in 2019 or 2018, 2016, 2017, and all the stuff that was going on, all the killings that was going on by police, which the militia was acting as in the film, the similarities is uncanny, and it kind of shows you that how film, you know how we always say reality is stranger than fiction? But in cases like with horror, especially horror, because horror mimics a lot of reality, and especially if it's a social horror like Night of the Living Dead, there's things that you can't ignore. There's things that you can't say, oh, it's just film and it's just horror. I'm like, no. It isn't, because in Harnoor, there's a tagline where someone says, I think it's Tanana Rev Du, who said, horror is black horror, right? A lot of the things that affect people in film affect us, especially in films like this, affect us as black people. And it was like, I don't think there's a film apart from Get Out that exemplifies that more than Night of the Living Dead.
And that was one of the things that I, because I remember watching it as I was, like, when I was younger, and I was like, I was asking my cousin, like, why did he die? Mm. Like, this isn't how movies are supposed to work.
And the hero is always supposed to live.
Yeah. So it's a deep movie, and it's one that the fact that it is this deep and this dark and this relevant is why it has stayed at the center of a lot of
And things. It was kind of unintentionally this deep too, at least, because yeah. It all just hinges on the fact that George Romero casted Dwayne Johnson, because if it was a white man, for me personally as a black woman, it would not have the same impact as a film, one, and then as a story, two. It wouldn't have the same impact on me, but because he did, like, I think that was fortuitous or serendipitous or like fate or whatever that he cast Dwayne Jones, because the film wouldn't have the same, I don't think the film would have had the same impact.
I agree, and I don't think it would have had as much lasting power. Mm. But I think killing the hero, it would have, at the time, it would have still had some impact. But I agree that it would not be something that is getting into the Library of Congress and being preserved for future generations to see, because it wouldn't have been as relevant. But all of this points to the main crux of zombies and what zombies serve as and why zombies are never just zombies is because zombies are the most human monster. They were human at one time. And now they're not, and we're confronted with ourselves when we fight them. So one of the other lenses that people have watched the movie from too has been looking through the Vietnam War through the lens, looking at this through the lens of the Vietnam War. And so Elliot Stein, a cultural critic of the Village Voice, saw the film as an ardent critique of American involvement in the Vietnam War, arguing that it was not set in Transylvania, but Pennsylvania. Mm. This was Middle America at war, and the zombie carnage seemed a grotesque echo of the conflict raging in Vietnam. And then, ultimately, the biggest piece of social horror is that we're watching, and I've already said it multiple times, but I'm gonna hammer it home, they're us. Zombies are us. The people who kill Ben are us. We're the people in the house. We're Ben. All of, like, none of this is outside the realm of possibilities. It isn't. And granted, they were made by a meteor strike. I think is technically what I think it is.
Yeah, that's what they thought it was. Yeah.
Yeah. It could have been a meteor. Not confirmed. But ultimately, it's still all humans. And this this is why Night of the Living Dead serves as the crux of social horror. And then Dawn of the Dead, which follows it, is a heavy critique of capitalism and consumerism, because at the end of the day, the zombies just keep going back to the mall. The other but why, though, is copyright your damn work. That is the biggest but why, though. If you are going to create anything, copyright it, because Night of the Living Dead entered the public domain in the United States because its original theatrical distributor, the Walter Reed Organization, neglected to place a copyright indication on the prints. In 1968, United States copyright law required that a proper notice for a work to maintain copyright. Image 10 displayed such a notice on the title frames of the film beneath the original title, Night of the Flesh Eaters. Doesn't have a really catchy tone.
No.
They changed it to Night of the Living Dead, and the distributor forgot to add the copyright statement on the new title card.
That is,
yeah.
What an oversight.
Yep. They've lost a lot of money because of it. Because of that, Night of the Living Dead was not copyrighted and has had multiple VHS, DVD, and Blu-ray releases, a lot of which George A. Romero did not see any money from.
The royalties, my goodness.
Yep. And remakes comes directly out of that, because if there is no copyright on your material, people can just pick it up and run with it once it's in the public domain. So the first remake actually happened in 1990, and it was directed by special effects artist Tom Savini. If that name sounds familiar, if you look up a picture of him, you'll know who he is. He's a really recognizable face. And it was based directly on the original screenplay, but it included more gore and a revised plot that portrayed Barbara, who is played by Patricia Tallman in this one, as a actual active and capable woman, and not just telling people to run to the basement.
Oh, yeah. Improvements were made.
And this was made with the approval of George A. Romero, actually, so this is the only remake that was made with his involvement. And Tony Todd played Ben, and Tony Todd is one of, like, he's a horror icon, pretty much.
Candyman, if you don't know.
That still scares me. Do not say that another time.
Sorry, I know. No more than two times. I will say more than two times.
And then film historian Barry Grant saw the new Barbara as a corrective on the part of Romero, suggesting that he made the character stronger to rectify the depiction of the female characters in the original film, because Romero, as I said, was involved with this. And this is the only remake we're going to talk about, because there are a lot of them. A lot of them. Independent fan companies do it. There's a 3D animation of it, which Tony Todd's voice is in, apparently. There is a whole bunch of weird stuff, and ultimately, as of 2017, Amazon.com lists copies of Night of the Living Dead numbering 15 of VHS, 121 different DVDs, 5 different Blu-rays, and 28 different Amazon video titles.
Oh, the time of DVD when everybody could make
one. and you can actually view or download the video for free on a lot of sites, like the Internet Archive or YouTube, because it's public domain. Mm-hmm. So no excuse to not watch it. It's everywhere. It's literally everywhere. It also brought on splatter horror, which I know you all give me a lot of crap for my subgenres in horror, but it's a thing.
Everything's a horror movie.
Everything is a horror movie, Matt. But
you get a horror
this
movie.
Is specifically.
Are we going to horrorception? Is that what's going to happen here?
Yep.
Oh my god!
Awesome.
Leave me alone.
Favorite time. My favorite time.
Not only did Night of the Living Dead bring on the zombie subgenre, it does bring on the splatter horror subgenre. Splatter horror is a subgenre of horror film that deliberately focuses on graphic portrayals of gore and graphic violence. Time out.
So, can a zombie movie be of the subgenre of a zombie horror movie plus a subgenre of now a splatter horror movie, which is also a zombie movie, which is also another subgenre, which is another subgenre.
It's both things at once.
So splatter horror zombie movie is one subgenre, and then zombie movie is another subgenre, and then splatter horror itself is another subgenre.
That's not how it works, Matt. It's.
I think I got this down, Adrian.
Yeah.
I am more lost. I didn't think that was possible.
Also, Carolyn, just to pull you in on the joke, they make fun of me because I like to talk about the different subgenres of horror. Not all horror is the same.
No, it's not.
And and this is what they do.
Well, you know.
Specifically, splatter horror films usually use this through special effects and display a fascination with the vulnerability of the human body, and theatrically of its own mutilation. Body horror is adjacent to this. So, splatter horror cinema is...
like how she tried to cover that up so Matt wouldn't hear it.
Wait a minute, what was that other one?
Horror is adjacent to
this movie now a subgenre of a splatter horror, which is a subgenre of a zombie movie, which is a subgenre of a body horror movie.
And comedy, forgot about comedy.
It is a comedy. It was written as one. It doesn't act like one. That's one thing I never understood, because it's classified, or like they made it out to be a horror comedy, and never once do I feel that way. I am uneasy the entirety of the movie after the first zombie pops up.
Wait, which film are we talking about? We start talking about Night of the Living Dead, right?
Yeah.
What part of that film is supposed to be comedy?
Right?
Huh.
It was supposed to be.
But you know what? People said the same thing about Get Out. And we were like, Get Out has humorous elements, but it is not funny. There's a difference.
Yeah, yeah. That movie's funny for, like, for the first 5 minutes until he gets to the house, and everything after that is not funny.
Exactly. You're like, you know what? This ish is smelling fishy. Like, something's up.
So this directly influenced movies like The Reanimator, Evil Dead, and Dead Alive, which are notoriously extremely gory movies. Anyway, zombies eating guts and things, this is where you get all of those popular shots of intestines and all of that. All that good stuff started here. None of that was in horror before this movie. And this actually caused a really big controversy because there was no MPAA rating system in place at movie theaters before, for a while, actually, after this. But there wasn't one in place. And essentially, it was shown in a Saturday afternoon matinee with preteens and children in the audience.
That's good for them. They needed that.
And this is what they saw. So a lot of critics gave Romero a lot of crap for it, and this was one of the reasons why it took a while for The Night of the Living Dead to become critically acclaimed, because it was so shocking to watch on screen, especially realizing that kids could watch it, which is tamed in, like, to today's standards, because now you have torture porn and all that stuff happening with, like, Eli Roth, and I can't watch any of that anymore.
Yeah, I don't do torture porn.
I used to be able to stomach it, and now I'm just like, this is too much.
No, I can't do, like, any of the Saw films. No, nothing like that.
I used to be able to.
I can do the first two Saw films. After that, I'm done.
I've never seen any of them.
It's increasingly bad. The first one's not.
So the first one's amazing. Yeah. I love the first Saw movie.
Yeah, I would.
That's, like, the only, I guess, well, technically not the only horror movie, because I don't know what subgenre we got, but what movie I count as horror, probably one of the only actual movies I consider horror that I actually enjoy.
Yeah, and that one's not too bad on the gore. It's bad, but not like the other ones.
Doesn't matter. The end is just amazing.
Yeah, the end is really good. And as we've talked about through this entire thing, the final but why, though, is that it is the progenitor, and I really wanted to use that word because it just sounded really cool to use it this, because it's, but it's the progenitor of the modern zombie movie. It is the reason we have all of the zombies that we have today. Before this, as Carolyn talked about, it was all based on the Haitian idea of a zombie, so it was about a body being controlled, and that body is still alive, or the body is dead, but it's being controlled and kept somewhere, or it was something that was hypnotized and kept alive. So a White Zombie and I Walked with a Zombie are two of, like, the first zombie films. They're incredibly bad. Don't watch them ever. Just start with George A. Romero and go forward. You don't need that in your life. And so essentially what happens after this is you get reanimated corpses that eat the flesh of people. And for Adrian and Matt, he said that zombies eat brains. Never once did it say in here that zombies ate brains. And there's actually very few instances on screen of zombies eating brains.
Yeah, there's...
That's a...
No, I know they eat brains in warm bodies. And I'm trying to think. Because generally in films they eat flesh. But I know warm bodies is the only one that's coming to mind where they specifically target the brain.
I zombie, right. They only eat brains. Yeah, they only eat brains in that one.
So, Borderlands is a DLC that's called Zombie. I think it's pretty much Zombieland, where all they do is yell brains.
Yeah, that's kind of.
I'm pretty sure Red Dead Redemption DLC. They also.
Oh, the game.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. We have references.
All this to say is that popular culture says brains.
Yes, and that was the point.
Why? Why is that a thing? Do you know why?
No, I don't know why, actually. I looked it up and I couldn't find it. It's the same reason why, like, I couldn't really find the first person who called Romero's zombies. It's just something that happened.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. Because usually there's a citation for when something like this shifts.
Yeah. Well, I think it depends on the movie. Because, like I said, the games, usually they have the zombies target, like, or yell brains out of fun stuff. And then I think, like, when we go to the... Don't some of, like, the more comedy zombies, like, go with the brain
like,
stuff?
Yeah, like iZombie and Warm Bodies.
Yes, and then Shaun of the Dead, doesn't they also do brains in that one?
I don't think so. No, they go for the body.
I couldn't remember at the end if he's just sitting there eating a brain or not. when he has him locked in the
shed. Right, because he has Ed locked in the shed, right? Chained in,
Yeah.
I don't think he's eating a brain in that, though. I think he's just locked in the shed. He's just locked in this in the shed with the TV.
Yeah, because they play the video games.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is totally a Gizmodo thing that I just Googled, so I don't, this isn't Kate's, like, actual research. But this thing says the first feature movie to have zombies eating brains was Return of the Living Dead in 1995.
Okay.
So that's like way after, actually. Like super after.
So, and what I want to know is that what started it, or were people saying brains before and then that's why it got done?
Before that. Interesting. I have no idea.
Yeah.
I don't know. Now I'm curious.
So this...
Do zombies poop? Was a question that was also asked in this article. I don't know. That's okay, a good question.
So, Max Brooks, horror writer, the guy behind World War Z and stuff, he actually put together a really detailed breakdown of zombie anatomy, zombie, like, lore. He essentially took together all types of zombie lore and then, like, distilled it into, like, a book, like, a... kind of like an anatomy book kind of thing.
Yeah, and any anatomist showed that World War Z was impossible.
Yes.
Because blood doesn't move that fast.
Yeah. Blood doesn't move that fast, but also essentially zombies would just eat until their stomach falls out.
Yeah, because they lack impulse control, right? Or they lack the thing that would turn off.
Yes.
No, not that they lack impulse control. They have impulse control. They lack the part of the brain that should be functioning, which would say, okay, you're full, would be dead.
Exactly. Yes. And so they just keep eating. Yeah. And then because they're not truly alive, they can't get rid of the waste. So they just eat until their stomach falls out, and then they just keep eating after that.
Which kind...
Yeah, but nobody's going to make a movie that's long enough.
That was actually addressed once in The Walking Dead. And that was in the... season... 3, when Laurie dies. Because remember...
Oh, that's right.
They find... Carl finds the walker in the thing where he and Maggie had to perform the C-section on Laurie, and there was a walker, and that was its guts were like stuffed.
Yeah.
So I think that was the only time that was ever addressed in The Walking Dead.
It like scarred Carl.
Yeah.
That was also one of the last times I actually liked Carl.
Yeah. Because I think that zombie had eaten. I'm trying to remember if the zombie had eaten Laurie or they hadn't, because I remember there was a thing with the ring, and I was like.
Yeah, I thought eaten Laurie.
Yeah, I thought it
did eat Laurie, right? Because they had to take the baby away, and she was in the room, and it came and found her and just gorged on her.
Yeah.
So I think that was the only time that was ever addressed in the film. I mean, in the show, sorry, in the show.
So all of this is to say...
back when The Walking
Dead was... Oh, my gosh.
So I have some breakdowns.
Mm-hmm.
I have Resident Evil, which is science zombies.
Yes.
So zombies being made through science. It isn't a natural effect. It is a company that manufactured the T-virus that's supposed to be used in cosmetic products to make your skin better and make you younger. And they were supposed to sell it for a lot of money, but then it ended up reanimating people. And then they decided to focus on making that as a military thing. And then the Raccoon City was overtaken by zombies.
No way. They took a virus and they made it military?
Here's the thought. Who would ever do something so insane?
And then we have fast zombies, because Resident Evil zombies for the longest time are not fast. They just stumble around. Fast zombies, 28 Days Later, as well as Dawn of the Dead 2003. I can't remember which one came first. I think 28 Days Later comes first. But this is where the debate comes. Is 28 Days Later a zombie movie? Because the people are not reanimated. They're just infected with a rage virus. So technically, they don't fit Carolyn's definition of a zombie.
Yeah, to me, they're not. They don't fall under necessarily zombie. Because to me, zombie, you have to die. And your neocortex has to get overridden by whatever viruses. And that's what reanimates you and it brings back. So they're infected. But they weren't fully dead. So they never died. So for me, a zombie is something you have to be declared medically dead. You have to be dead for at least a minute or whatever, and then come back to be considered a zombie. That's by my definition.
So would they be ghouls?
But what is dead? What if their soul is dead during that transition? All I'm thinking about is that scene in 28 Days Later where the crow drops that blood in that dude's eyeball, and that dude is dead. That's not the same person. His brain is rewired.
He didn't die. Like, his heart didn't stop. They say you have to be what we would call clinically dead. So now you mentioned the soul, and that's interesting because in Warm Bodies, that's actually addressed, because Warm Bodies, they actually come back alive because their souls, they weren't fully dead. It was kind of like they were in a, there, it was kind of like they're, we're in a, what's the word I want to look for? A stasis kind of thing, because like in Warm Bodies, what happens, R, which is played by Nicholas Holt, he's the first zombie because he's dead, but like he can communicate with his friend, and like they make grunts and noises and occasionally make eye contacts and stuff, but they're dead but not really dead because he didn't have a heartbeat, right? And medically you have to be considered dead if your heart stops beating, because you can be brain dead or you can be brain dead and still be considered medically alive, but you're only considered medically dead once your heart stops beating and it has to stop and it has to be flatlined for a specific amount of time.
Why can't it just be a subgenre of zombie?
You're just being facetious now.
But dude, so Warm Bodies, isn't that the young adult?
Yeah, it's young adult. Yeah,
hey, it's clinically underrated.
I really like that movie. Okay. It's a really good movie.
Okay.
It's really funny.
Okay, maybe you have to check that one out, because that one, I remember the trailers and I'm like, I'm not.
No, you should watch it. It does have a tiny bit of gore, but because that's one of the ones where they eat head brains too. But it's kind of like, it's like a lighthearted,
it's more
twisted rom-com.
Zombieland. Yeah, or like a rom-com. Like, yeah, it's more akin to like a funny, like...
It's morbid more than horrific.
Is not necessarily the main thing.
Yeah, it's more morbid than horrific.
Yeah. It's really good. I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't want to see Rob as a zombie man? Not Rob Zombie, but like the actor. Rob Cord... I never said his last name. Cordry? Cordry? M in the
That's Nicholas Holt.
Yeah.
Dang, who the hell are you talking about, Adrian?
The main guy, I thought the main guy was Nicholas Holt.
No, that he's R. I'm talking about
Oh, yeah, you're right. He's R. Nicholas Holt is R. His friend is M. Yeah, right, yeah. Who's he?
Rob Corddry. Corddry.
Oh,
He's a zombie in that one, Matt, and he's hilarious.
I need to look it up because
I haven't seen it in a long time.
In the
Rom Corddry. Okay, I don't know that man's name. He's one of those side actors that you know the face, but you don't know the name.
I'm looking him up. No.
He's hit or miss with me. Sometimes he goes full Andy Samberg, and I can't do it.
Oh, yeah, him.
What?
Well, no, I'm looking up the thing on IMDb. What? I know that actor, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Adrian's going, what? Because Matt is once again declaring that he hates Andy Samberg on the podcast.
But, like, how...
No, I don't really... To me, he's like, eh. I don't, like, he's not really my radar, so...
But, like, the connection just isn't...
He hosted Shark Week. That's a disgrace. But, okay, so back to different movies. We got Warm Bodies. 28 days later, we are declaring that they are just rage
it
humans.
Is, so, officially, it is an infection horror movie. But, if you look up any top horror movie... Any top zombie movies, it gets brought up. So
the
pop
only thing I like about that movie... Okay. The only thing I do like about that movie is the theme song of that movie is amazing.
Oh, it was really good.
For Warm Bodies?
Days 28
Days Later. 28 Days Later?
No, 28 Days Later.
Yeah, so the next movies are zombie comedies, which there are a lot of in the 80s. Evil Dead, one of them. Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2. Bruce Campbell being the amazing final boy, Ash. Directed by Sam Raimi. They're great movies. You should watch them. But Shaun of the Dead is probably the one that most people know. Simon Pegg, the first of the Cornetto trilogy with Nick Frost and Simon Pegg. Which did an amazing job. And I don't, like, everybody knows how good this is. But, like, it's great from a comedic standpoint. But it's also great as a horror fan. Because they live out every damn trope in almost every damn zombie movie you can think of. And
yeah, they just went full tilt.
Yep.
I mean, they even end up in a bar in the dumb decision of, like, we can be here.
Oh, and it's for his girlfriend.
Well, it was their...
They do make dumb decisions
it
for
was
his
for
girlfriend.
Oh, yeah, they do. Because they end up in the bar, like, I will save you, and they end up in this bar, like, we'll end up here. And his girlfriend was terrible, wasn't she?
She was terrible. She was mean.
Yes. Yeah, she was terrible. You should have left her.
Yeah, wow. You know, these things
So what is everybody's thoughts on Shaun of the Dead? and they're zombies.
I love that film. It's hilarious. I watched it a couple times when it first came out, and I loved it. It's utterly ridiculous, and I love British comedy because I find British humor is kind of like, I would say, Barbadian humor, where it's very dry and sarcastic. And I love that kind of humor. So I love British comedies. Like, one of my favorite comedies is Are You Being Served?
Why does that sound
or a show, Keeping Up Appearances. Are You Being Served was like, yes, Minister was like, this one, these people worked in a department store. And so, like, there was, like,
the manager.
Yeah, and then there was Keeping Up Appearances with Miss Bouquet or Miss Meg or Miss... Are you... Miss Bouquet is resident, Lady of the House speaking. but no, I love, like, English comedy. So, like, when I watched Shaun of the Dead, I'm like, this is right up my alley. Because you got horror and British comedy all amalgamated into one. And it's like, I love when they know that things are ridiculous and they just lean full into the ridiculousness of everything. They're like, we're going to take it up at every notch we can to just, like, outdo every scene.
I also think the best use of Queen in a movie is in Shaun of the Dead.
Yes.
Zombie killing to Don't Stop Me Now this is perfect.
Don't stop. Yeah, yeah. That's the one with the jukebox, yep. Right? And they're just, like, banging at the guy with the thing. Yeah.
Then you have popular zombies, which you kind of talked a little bit about, The Walking Dead. Which that probably deserves its own episode when the current season wraps up, because that's kind of going to be the last for a lot of the people that we started the show with, and I no longer care. I stopped caring when they got to Terminus.
I stopped caring. I've said this a lot on Twitter, but like, I almost stopped caring when Glenn died, but I held on because of Michonne, literally because of Michonne, Rick, and Carl, and Maggie. After Glenn died, like, they were literally the only reasons I almost stopped watching because of that. I held on, and then did the whole fake out, and then the whole mess with Negan's storyline, atrociousness, garbage, crap, and I'm like, done. It's the first time I've ever stopped watching a show, and I did not miss it. Like, sometimes I think, oh, man, I used to watch this show, really? Talk about taking a nosedive in quality, right?
I don't miss it.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't miss it, I really, really enjoyed to, like, not caring so fast.
And, like,
I started writing because of The Walking Dead. I started writing because I used to do recaps for The Walking Dead. That's how much I love that show. That's how I started deciding to pursue, like, film criticism and television and writing about film and TV because of the friggin' Walking Dead, and they just shit all over that. Fixed me so upset.
Tell me how you really feel.
Listen, if we ever do a Walking Dead thing and I ever go on it, I will be like, I would have to work and go and, like, calm myself down, because, like, I get upset just thinking. I've never seen a show that went from being so good to being complete trash.
That's completely fair. I only watch it because I'm a completionist. That's the only
reason. I'm usually like that, but I give up. I cannot put myself through that horror anymore.
Yeah.
That to me is the real horror story right there.
Oh gosh, that's so good. Okay, so since we were talking about World War Z, we're going to skip past that and go straight to Train to Busan and Kingdom. Some Korean zombies, because
that's literally the only one I wanted to talk about was World War Z.
Oh, well.
I know.
We can go back.
Of all the movies, the only one I was like,
we can go back to World War Z too.
No, we'll go back.
We're going to move on. You've already killed it for me. I get how this goes. I'll just take my
There's always one. There's one point in every episode where I do this to him.
Oh, no.
No, so World War Z is based on Max Brooks' world of zombies. He did the Zombie Survival Guide, and he did the World War Z books. These zombies are really cool. They're pretty much hybrids. They are very, very fast. They eat flesh, but they also have a dormant period where they move very, very slowly or don't move at all. So they're kind of like everything in a zombie, and it's terrifying. The movie, I did not know I was going to love as much as I do.
Yeah,
exactly. Considering nothing, like, happens.
Yeah, oh wait, yeah. He gets some medicine.
Like, for the most part, like, I actually enjoy the movie, but when you look at it and you break it down, the actual movie, nothing really happens other than they go on a plane and they, like, fly around, do a little investigation, and then he takes some medicine. Even though they have the weird part where the poor little scientist dude at a college shoots himself.
That was depressing. That movie got dark real quick in that moment.
It was... halfway out of nowhere, and it, I don't know if you're supposed to laugh at that part, but it was very, like,
it was jarring. Because they're like, oh, we're all gonna go save stuff, and then, like, the youngest scientist out of all of them decides to kill himself. I'm just like,
he doesn't decide, he slips and trips.
Yeah, because that's how he got shot, right?
Yeah, he slips and he shoots himself on accident. He didn't kill himself, he trips. No, he trips walking out of the plane.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, no, he trips walking out of the plane and shoots himself.
That is really sad.
And everybody's like, oh, we're the people that's supposed to save the world, and our scientist just tripped out of a plane.
Ridiculous.
It's very dark, and it's kind of definitely dark, like, humor if you laugh at it, but it was like, we're going to save the world, and then they literally trip out of a plane, like, oh, and there's our only hope.
I know, that was so ridiculous. I'm like, what the hell?
I will say this, I do think that Brad Pitt's character was the smartest person I've ever seen in a zombie movie. Because he immediately goes into, like, I'm going to assess what's happening around me. I'm going to count out how long it takes for somebody to turn. Like, he actually uses, like, common sense, and it gets him pretty far.
The only thing I don't like about the movie is the plane crash, because it, like, we got absurd. I was please don't do it. Please don't do it.
The wall of zombies, or the zombies climbing on a mountain over the wall, that was an absurd. Yeah. The plane crash was absurd.
But the zombies creating like a thing that actually makes sense because they all have one driving force, right? So they're gonna
just climb together.
Because it's the same thing in Train to Busan with the train. You remember at the close to the end with the train where they're all like holding onto the train, and it's basically the same thing. And the train eventually slows down strictly because of their weight. Terrifying.
And which we can move to that movie now. We got to talk about it. I'm good now. I know Carolyn's been wanting to talk about it.
No, go back. But it's like that's the two moments. That's the moment where like you have like where like zombies acting as a real horde actually makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. Train to Busan and Kingdom, because a lot of the zombie movies that we see are when it comes to horror movies in general, this is probably one of this and exorcisms. These are two of the things that are almost like uniquely American like type films. In that the majority of them are produced in the U.S., right? Because, like, movies based on ghosts, that's everywhere. Movies on seances, that's everywhere. But out of those categories...
World War Z wasn't in America, was it? World War Z wasn't in America.
It was an American
It was filmed in the Middle East. Like, Tel Aviv, I think, wasn't it?
No, it was in there. Max Brooks is from the U.S.,
it goes all over the world because it begins in the U.S. So where Brad Pitt meets his family, and then it goes to the Middle East and stuff. Yeah.
So I'm talking about like where the horror movie came from, not like where they go in the horror movie.
Yeah. Oh, you mean the R.E.M. film? Okay.
I was like, they go over where the first
Agent Zero was. I'm talking about where the creator of the... So like when it comes to horror, there are a lot of things, there are a lot of genres that happen in
the production,
But uniquely, two of the subgenres are exorcism and zombie that we get the majority of. We don't only have them, but those are two things that have defined American horror. And so to see Train to Busan come up, it was amazing. And the moment that got on Netflix, I was back on zombies.
Did I first watch it on Netflix? No. I watched Train to Busan online because of Gang Yu.
What's that?
But anywho, we'll get into that later. Gang Yu, that's the lead actor. That's my boo from Coffee Prince and Goblin. Hey!
I'm sorry. I have not seen Goblin yet because it is not available in the U.S. anymore. And all the sites I have to say...
Because it was mainly hosted mainly on Drama Fever, but they went defunct last year, and it was completely heartbroken. I'm gonna send you a link.
Okay. Yeah. So Train to Busan is a Beijing, South Korean horror movie where essentially they get on a train and somebody is and Korea is going through a zombie outbreak. One person is affected on the train, and of course you're in close quarters. zombies break out everywhere. And it's really cool because you see them run, and they're fast zombies. It's a fast-acting infection. So, like, it doesn't even, like, kill you and then you turn. Like, it's kind of like the World War Z one. Like, you turn as you're there. Like, it's not like Walking Dead, I'm sick and I'm dying. Now I'm a zombie. There's no time to react. It's almost instantaneously. They also go dormant when it's dark, which is really cool. So they still stand up and everything. They're still there. But if it's dark, they stay hidden because they can't see, is what it kind of establishes. But when they hear sound,
I love that so
they'll
much.
Attack.
I love that so much.
It's so good.
The way that is utilized in the film
is one of the best things I've seen.
In years. Okay, so Train to Busan. So it's a 2016 film directed by Yong Sang-ho and written by Yong Sang-ho and Park Joo-suk. So, and it stars Gong Yoo, Ma Dong-suk, and Kim Soo-won. Now, this film, it starts out, what I love about this film, as typically most horror films does, it starts out very seemingly mundane, because it's like Gong Yoo's character, he is a corporate guy. He works for a pharmaceutical company. I think it's a pharmaceutical company. And there was something that was going on, and there was a mistake that was made. It seems like it's his mistake, but he's claiming responsibility for it when I don't think it was, because what happened can't be the responsibility of one person. But I knew this film was going to be the ish when in the opening scene there's a deer. Now, I'm not going to spoil anything. You have to see the scene to believe the scene. This thing, I've never been terrified of a deer to Train to Busan. I was like, what the hell is going to happen in this freaking movie? And then he goes, and then the thing with Train to Busan, it's not just about zombies. It has a story about a father-daughter relationship, and there's a relationship between husband and wife, boyfriend and girlfriend, friends. It has a lot of different relationships that they actually take time to explore. And given the pace of the film, I think the director did an amazing job of balancing the stories, because you get to know each character, you get to appreciate them and grow to actually like them, and you want them to survive and you root for all of them. And so it's set in a bullet train. So this is the thing. You have a zombie film set on a bullet train. And what makes a bullet train so effective as a set piece for a film like this is because it has one direction. It keeps the pace of the movie going, because you have to follow the pace of the train. And you start from point A and you're going to end up at point Z. And you have stops and starts because the train makes stops. And the challenge is like you normally, as a person who rides the train, you want the train to make a stop because you want to get off. And that's one of the things I found kind of interesting, because as someone who rides the train regularly here in Toronto, I was like, I am accustomed to being on a train. And like when something goes wrong, like there's always this sense of exasperation. You're like, oh no, what could it be now? But with this film, when the train stops, you're like, no, I don't want to describe, you're not exasperated, you're terrified, because you're like, what new horror is going to walk through this, is going to come crashing through this door? And it does happen at one of the train stops, at one of the train stations. This is where it's really like, the pace of the film really went up. And they got off because they were looking to find out what happened, because they didn't know. They were receiving all their information by phone. And then eventually the phone services were cut out. And so they literally had, normally, you know, we would say, why are you getting out? Stay on the train, whatever. But it came where you actually understood why they had to leave the train, and it makes sense to the plot. And then they realize there's a horde of these fast, ridiculously fast-paced zombies just like coming at you, and they come out like in like a wave. So they're kind of, so that's why I mentioned the zombies in World War Z are kind of like that, because these ones, they like, you know, like they move as a true horde. They like move as like just a wave of like bodies coming at you, and then they make it back to the train, and then it's like more tension because they don't understand the true six. Before, they didn't have a real idea of what was going on in the film, but now they do. And that's when they're realizing, like, okay, we have to come with a plan. And this is what I always talk about this. With Train to Busan, one of the things I love about this film, which is many, is they all come up with a plan. So, like, there's a core group, and they all come up with a plan. And they stick to the plan. Nothing like in Night of the Living Dead where Ben is like, you know what, let's do this. How about we do this? And you have Barbara and her husband are saying, no, let's go do this other thing. No, none of that foolishness. In Train to Busan, they all came up with a plan and they stuck to the plan. And it worked for a time being. And the reason I'm not going to spoil it because I always want people to watch this movie, but the reason it stopped working, the reason why the plan didn't work, it was because of something that someone else did. And this is all because of the arrogance of man. And this is where the film also discusses class and class and you know, like class distinctions, where you have the haves and the have-nots, and the rich want to be separated from what they consider from the poor. So like, this is how the director actually discussed class in a very clever way, though, actually pointing out that this is what the discussion is about. And I just love this film. The action is ridiculous. Madam Suk is amazing. You love his character. They're all like badass. Even the little girl is like, she's so sweet. And like the relationship between the family and the friends is amazing. I just love this film.
Well,
I do. And it has one of the most heartbreaking endings ever. Really, and it's not heartbreaking because it's heartbreaking. There's two things. It's heartbreaking because there's a moment that's like super sad. Like you're sobbing tears down your face. And then there's a moment at the very end where you're sobbing out of relief because you're like, oh my God. You're like,
then there's a song and it makes you want to cry. Have another Ben moment where it's like people.
Yes.
Like, for a moment you think like it, you don't. Yeah. Just watch it. It does. One of the great things and what has made great zombie movies great is because they're able to pull off that tension. And I would say recently Train to Busan is the only really good zombie movie that I've seen. And ultimately, because I don't know if you guys, because I know Adrian, Matt, y'all haven't seen Train to Busan, but have y'all seen Snowpiercer?
Snowpiercer is another great one. And that's a Korean, and that's actually directed by a Korean director because it's directed by the same director who did Okja and another famous Korean horror movie called The Host.
I've seen The Host. I love The Host. Okay. Well, because I was going to say,
so it's the same director.
If you've seen Snowpiercer, that type of pacing throughout the cars that happens in Snowpiercer, that's the type of pacing that happens in Train to Busan. And it's exactly like how you said, Carolyn. Because the nature of the train itself pushes it along, and it doesn't miss a damn beat. It's really good.
All I know is that I listened to my wife yell in the other room for 2 hours, and then she cried like unconsolably for like 30 minutes after the movie ended. So
tears,
I'm not
Matt.
Watching this movie,
Adrian. I'm telling you, like I was I've watched this film 3-4 times already because we did it twice for Saturday Night Sci-Fi, because it's literally one of my favorite films. I would put it in my top 5 films of all time of any genre. And I am a sobbing mess at the end. Tears, like, I'm not even exaggerating, like, tears will be coming down my face. I'll be like, oh my God, my heart. And it's very rare that an action movie and a horror film is able to, like, make you cry for two very different reasons. As I said, there is a moment you cry because of absolute despair, but then you cry out of like pure joy and release and relief, and it's like, I love this film.
And I will say this, I didn't think about it until you said it. There aren't stupid decisions in the movie. Like, there are stupid decisions, but they're antagonistic decisions. Like, people are purposely trying to sabotage other people, and that's why the decisions.
That's the beauty of it.
Like, that is, like, there aren't dumb decisions in this movie. Like, people purposely do things knowing the
people make what we call the bad decision that we call them bad because they put people in jeopardy because of selfishness and not because it was a stupid decision, because technically there's a particular character who does make a bad decision, and what he did is technically smart, but it was a bad decision because it was out of arrogance and pure selfishness, and because he thought his life was worth more than everyone.
So
no one makes a stupid decision in this film. No one.
So at the end of the day, we really wanted to cover this, or I really wanted to cover Night of the Living Dead, because it is extremely influential in an entire subgenre of horror. It's extremely influential in horror more largely. And I think it's something that as we've gotten further and further away from it, especially with so many zombies being pumped into pop culture, we've forgotten a lot of the societal impact, the societal mirroring that zombie movies did before. And it's important to kind of pay attention to that. Oh. thoughts on Night of the Living Dead and what we just talked about for zombies?
Zombies are cool. Even though my zombies aren't zombies, apparently, which makes me sad. I think it's cool. I think we covered this a little bit in episode 8, and we didn't cover it nearly as much as we should have, and we didn't really even cover, like, zombies. Like, this isn't, like, the point of this episode, right? But, like, the genre itself is so big with all of its subgenres and all that stuff, so I learned a whole bunch more than we got to cover in our horror episode, so thank you, Carolyn, for coming on.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I wish The Walking Dead was better, and I am ready to get my zombie fix in Game of Thrones.
Oh yeah, Game of Thrones has zombies.
Ice zombies.
Another subgenre of zombies. They actually die and come back, so they fit the bill.
They do.
Matt.
Thanks, Carolyn, for coming on. It was very enjoyable. Had a lot of fun. I guess I like zombies a little more than what I did before I started this episode, but not by much.
There's a slight improvement, slight more appreciation.
I still like the 28 Days Later theme song, even though I don't think I've ever seen the actual movie, or at least all of it. I have seen the Crow part. I like World War Z, I like Shaun of the Dead, and the rest of them are what they are. And I might watch Warm Bodies, only depending on things. That's where
Warm Bodies is really good. Warm Bodies is good.
So I got like 5 zombie movies. Out of all the rest of the horror movies, you're doing okay, zombies, compared to what I watch. But Carolyn, you should... But to be fair, though, it was good. Night of the Living Dead, we see it ended up being a lot of stuff. I don't really care for black and white movies. It's sometimes really hard to watch. But we'll say, Carolyn, you need to watch at least Saw. I'm going to go watch Warm Bodies, and you need to watch Saw 1. Don't watch the rest of them. Just that one. Just the first
Scenes. I've seen scenes from Saw 1.
The first one's not that bad.
No. I would rewatch Final Destination.
Ooh, I love Final Destination.
Would that count? I'd rewatch Final Destination. I love those films.
No, that one's not bad.
One and two are better than three. Three was A.
Yeah.
About to say, another one of those, the first two aren't bad. I can count it. After that, they don't exist.
I'm not going to get my final thoughts because this entire episode was my final thoughts. And I said in the new year I was going to do more horror episodes. So here we are. Carolyn, what are your final thoughts?
My final thoughts are... I love horror films, and I love horror films that have a message, and they have a plot, and they have a story, and zombie movies can be very effective for that, because as you said, they're like a reflection of us. They show like the breakdown of society and how humanity, how we turn against ourselves, one, and two, how easy it is for us to like disassociate ourselves with the other. It's about setting ourselves up, which I think is done really well in Land of the Dead. Which is another George A. Romero film, like where there is like it should like, and also with Warm Bodies, where like once they because they came back to life, and you're like, and so it's a discussion of what makes humans humans. Is it our soul? Is it just being the ability to breathe and move and walk? What is it that makes us human? So that's I think what a great. That's why I think zombies are a great narrative tool. And again, watch Kingdom, watch Train to Busan, both on Netflix. And, you know, the branch out, like, even if, and if it's not your cup of tea, there's nothing wrong with that. Everyone has their preferences. Everyone has their things that turn them off and that they just don't do. So if it's not your cup of tea, again, it's fine to turn it down. I mean, that's probably what David should have done in Get Out, but, you know. Turn out that cup of tea.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much again, Carolyn, for coming on. Why don't you tell everybody listening where they can find you?
You can find me on Twitter. I tweet a lot. I tweet a lot about film, television. I co-host a Saturday Night Sci-Fi Live Tweets every Saturday night, 10 p.m. Eastern, where we do sci-fi themed films. You can find me at Carrie, CARRIECNH12 on Twitter. I co-host a podcast called So Here's What Happened with Lanisha Campbell, and which is also hosted by the Why the Podcast community. So you can find our podcast on on there as well. And we discuss film, television, and books. We discuss our top picks for the month, and we go through our reviews, which is a critical analysis of the why we like things and why something may not work, why films suck, why books suck, and why they're also great. I'm a film and TV critic, so I am published in Sci-Fi, on Sci-Fi Fangirl, sci-fi.com, The Root, and a few other websites as well. And if you need someone to guest host on podcasts and talk about film, that's me.
As always, you can find the podcast at But Why the PC on all social medias. If you haven't yet, make sure you rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you're listening. It really, really helps us out, and it's the best way to show your support. And as always, you can find me at OhMyMythRandier on Twitter. Adrian?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at SuperReese93, SuperReuiz93.
Matt?
You can find me in the attic.
Safest place to be, Matt. Safest place to be. Seek higher ground.